This is the Blind Guy, and you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. On today's edition, we replay two of our most informative interviews from 2012 about the pitfalls of our credit economic system, just in time for the holiday shopping season. The season is full of overindulgence of the culinary and financial kind, as well as those who are looking to prey on shoppers and donors. Even when you think you have things well in hand, you could fall victim to much woe down the line. First, host Robin Martinez talks with local attorney Dale Irwin about zombie debt, the debt that disappears and years later reappears. Find out how you can protect yourself from unscrupulous debt collectors. Then, in the second half of the show, Robin and Dale return to talk about the history and present-day reality of the payday loan industry in Missouri. A warning about how making special memories today can become nightmares that haunt you for years to come. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the show and the 420 drug war news at the end of the show.
Good morning. You're listening to Jaws of Justice on KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City's community radio. I'm Robin Martinez with the law firm of Martinez, Madrigal, and Machacow, and I'm a member of the Kansas City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. On Jaws of Justice, we typically talk about the criminal justice system. Today, we're going to take a little bit of a different turn and talk about economic justice, and in particular, what is a huge business in the United States, and that is the business of debt. Some of the most recent numbers showed that debt is phenomenally big in this country. American consumers owe approximately $11.38 trillion in debt. And a big piece of that, of course, is mortgage debt. But another big piece is credit card debt. The latest numbers, as of this last quarter, show that American consumers owe about $852 billion in credit card debt. Now, if you've been reading the news or watching television and following the economy, you realize that a lot of that debt has gone into default. That's because consumers have lost their jobs, can no longer afford to pay their debts, and that's created the term that we've referred to as zombie debt and the rise of debt collection agencies that are going around and increasingly chasing consumers down, trying to squeeze every last penny out of what is owed. Today, I have a guest on air with us. It is Dale Irwin. Dale is a consumer lawyer here in Kansas City with the law firm of Slough, Connealy, Irwin, and Madden. Dale has a long history of representing consumers. He's a member of the National Association of Consumer Advocates, and is very knowledgeable about this industry. So welcome, Dale, to Jaws of Justice.
Thank you, Robin.
And tell us a little bit about this term, zombie debt. What is zombie debt?
Well, as the name implies, debt that won't die. One of the reasons it's called that is because a lot of these debts that debt buyers purchase from credit card companies are very old debts. They're so old that they are past the statute of limitations, which governs how long one can file a lawsuit on one of these debts to recover. And they also, part of the name zombie comes from the fact that these debts will be purchased by one debt buyer. That debt buyer will try to collect on it, and for some odd reason will run into a defense or any number of reasons, will then just, when it fails to collect, will just sell the debt to another debt buyer, and then that debt buyer will in turn try and collect on the debt. And So the debt never goes away. We had one case where a guy had his credit card stolen, reported it stolen, and got the bank to change credit card numbers. And after that, the bank sent him statements billing him for charges that had been made on the card after it was stolen. He paid his part of the balance and complained to the bank, and they said they would reverse the charges. And the next month, the very same thing happened. More debts came on it. And so he got disgusted and just he paid what he owed. Then he just quit paying on it and told him he wasn't going to use it anymore. And then the bank sold this credit card debt that was all fraudulent charges to a debt buyer. That debt buyer came after this guy, and this is a college professor, by the way, came after him and would call his home, tell his wife that they were deadbeats, give them a lot of guff. And then when he finally convinced them that his card had indeed been stolen and furnished them with proof that he'd reported it to the police and all that, they backed off and sold the debt to another debt buyer. That debt buyer started the same process, harassing phone calls, the whole nine yards. But he finally convinced them that it wasn't his debt. They backed off. By this time, the account, even if it was valid, is past the statute of limitations. They sell it to another debt buyer. And in fact, in the account notes we got in the lawsuit, it showed that when they sold it to the other debt buyer, they clearly knew it was past the statute of limitations. The third debt buyer commences on the same campaign and does not back off, actually files a lawsuit against the guy. And at that point is when we got into the case and filed a counterclaim against the debt buyer and got into some fairly in-depth discovery, which means in the legal process that means you can make the other side show you all the documents that they have to back up their claims. And in that process discovered that this debt buyer knew darn good and well that the debt was disputed, that it was past the statute of limitations, and even went ahead and sued anyway. And we settled that case for a confidential amount, and that was that. And that's I've had several cases where the people have been sued on debts that were the result of stolen credit cards. And in all cases, we've always we've counterclaimed for malicious prosecution, saying that the debt buyer should not have sued them in the first place.
That's a remarkable story, Dale. But let's back up a little bit. You all of these debt buyers. Who are these debt buyers, and what is the debt buying business?
Well, the debt buying business is, as you pointed out just a minute ago, grew out of the savings and loan fiasco in which a lot of savings and loans failed some years back, and the accounts were being sold off kind of at wholesale basis to individuals or entities that would buy them for basically pennies on the dollar in many instances, and then pursue the debtors for that, and that's what debt buying is. Most of it, some of it's installment paper like car loans and that type of thing, but the vast majority of it is old credit card debt, and these debts are sold in portfolios of thousands at a time. And when the credit card company, you know, some national bank that issues a credit card, when that bank sells off that old stale debt, what the debt buyer gets is an Excel spreadsheet of, say, 5,000 or so accounts. And there will be one line for each account on that Excel spreadsheet, and it will have the debtor's name, Social Security number, last address, last balance on the account, maybe some other minimal information. And then the debt buyer will, based on just that spreadsheet information, will then file lawsuits, thousands at a time, and attach affidavits to the lawsuits, swearing that the person they're suing owes this debt. And they're swearing that based on nothing more than that one line on an Excel spreadsheet. No documents, no signed contracts, nothing in their file actually shows somebody agreed to pay that debt.
How can these debt buyers then make their case when they get to court?
Well, they can't. But if you show up and challenge them and ask for a trial date, 9 times out of 10, they will just dismiss maybe the day before the trial date, something like that, because they don't have the documents to back up the claim they're suing on. All they have are these affidavits they attach to the petitions, and these are what has commonly been come to be known as robo-affidavits or robo-signed affidavits, where a debt buyer employee will just sign affidavit after affidavit all day long, swearing that somebody owes money simply based on what they're seeing on that Excel spreadsheet on the computer screen.
But surely there's got to be some documentation somewhere back at the bank that would show that a consumer, you know, signed a credit card application or loan application, and then made a bunch of charges on that account to show that that money is owed. I mean, isn't that information available to the debt buyers? And why can't they rely on that to make their case or prove their case?
What you're referring to is in the debt buying industry and in the contracts that they sign when they buy these debts is referred to as media. Media means documents, evidence, basically, of the debt. And to understand how this works, you have to actually read one of the contracts between, say, the credit card company and the debt buyer. And I have seen several of those. It is common for those overall contracts governing the purchase and sale of this zombie debt will often have a clause in it that says something like, you, the debt buyer, agree that we don't know what we're selling you. This stuff could have been debt that was the result of identity theft. It could have been already discharged in bankruptcy. It could be invalid for any number of reasons. And so you, debt buyer, are agreeing that you're going to perform your own independent investigation into the validity of these debts before you sue on them. And of course, that never happens. They just sue en masse, and what happens is that most of the people that get sued default, don't show up in court, or if they do show up in court, don't know how to put the creditor to its proof and make them prove the debt was owed. And so they get a judgment against them. And this happens day after day, year after year. If you go down to Associate Circuit Court where these kinds of cases are filed, you can watch it happen. It is simply a mill that grinds on, and default judgments are issued by the bushel.
Again, this is Robin Martinez with the Kansas City Chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, and my guest today on Jaws of Justice Radio here on KKFI 90.1 FM is consumer lawyer Dale Irwin. Now, Dale, you just mentioned that the courts are pretty much full of a lot of these debt buyer cases where the debt buyers are suing consumers trying to collect on the debts. And you said that happens day in and day out. Virtually every day that the courts are open. Do you have any sense for the overall percentage of overall cases that are on a court's docket that are being brought by debt buyers and how much of our judicial resources are being soaked up by these types of cases?
No, I don't. All I have is anecdotal evidence. I haven't seen any studies on it. I do know that in the case that I was just discussing earlier of the professor whose card was stolen, In discovering that case, we found out that this one debt buyer was filing something like 9,000 lawsuits a year in Missouri alone. And so it is a huge business that takes up a lot of time and resources. I mean, when you typically hear the Chamber of Commerce types talking about the litigation explosion and too many lawsuits, you never hear them talking about lawsuits by debt buyers and payday loan companies and those kind of people that are clogging the courts. But they truly are taking a lot of time and resources and clogging the courts.
So who are these debt buyers? Who are some of the companies behind them, and how are they funded, and who are some of the big players in this business?
Some of the big players, there's LVNV LLC, which is it's a company that I don't know if they're still owned by a company called Sherman Acquisitions, but that LVNV is one of the bigger ones. Portfolio Recovery Services is another big one. Midland Credit Management is another big one. There are several big ones, and then a lot of smaller ones. There are some mom and pop debt buyer companies too. The one particular one in the professor's lawsuit I was talking about, in that case, it was a company called CACH out of Colorado, which is they're renamed now. I can't remember the name, but that was a case where I took the deposition of the guy that signed the affidavit. I got a judge that made them bring the guy to Kansas City from Denver so I could take his deposition. And as I was asking him, they had him prepared so that he wasn't going to budge on how trustworthy their information was. So I in the course of the deposition showed that all he did was sit there and look at a computer screen and then sign an affidavit based on what he saw on the computer screen. And so I asked him, I said, well, let's assume that you're looking at that computer screen, and on it says that the moon is made of green cheese. Would you then believe that your employer had researched it and indeed concluded that the moon was made of green cheese and that was a fact? And he said, yes. So that's the kind of the quality of the evidence that these judgments are rendered on in these kinds of cases.
Wow, that is remarkable that somebody would actually come out and say something like that in a deposition.
Well, his quote made it into the New York Times in an article about this debt buying business.
That is truly remarkable. Now, what happens when you have a debt buyer that goes to court and a consumer doesn't show up? And they get a judgment against them. What happens next?
Well, then they the collection process has become very technologically sophisticated. George Orwell had it right, only he just should have turned his focus about 30 degrees over, because it's not so much the government we need to worry about. It is the amazing ability of credit bureaus and collection agencies to find out every single facet of your life with just by logging onto a computer. There are computer programs out there that will tell someone not only where you work, but who your coworkers are, where they live, and who their neighbors are, and who your neighbors are. There is an endless ability to run you down and to harass you to collect. And there is also a very sophisticated automated system to file lawsuits, zillions at a time, and run them through the courts and run garnishments, find people's assets, checking accounts, and garnish those accounts, garnish wages to collect on these debts.
What's the impact on your average consumer who does wind up having their wages garnished or having their assets or bank account seized?
Well, as you know, if your bank account gets tied up and you have checks out or you have debit transactions outstanding or whatever, everything starts bouncing. And so you incur these $35 bounce check fees. It puts you into a spiral that's pretty tough to dig out of. And it is... is devastating for somebody that lives paycheck to paycheck. I sat down in court. I was in court yesterday, and there was a creditor was seeking to revive a judgment. Judgments only last for 10 years, and after that, you have to revive them, so they go another 10 years. And the debtor was down there. And, of course, she didn't know what was going on. She didn't know what defenses there are to reviving a judgment. All she knew was that she had been paying on an $8,000 debt through garnishment of her paycheck. She had paid over $12,000, and now they were going to revive the judgment and keep garnishing on her. And it was simply because, you know, interest kept accruing on this debt, and it was obvious she was never going to get it paid off, that this was going to be a monthly expense, much like rent, that was just going to have to come out of her check every month. And so people that, you know, aren't very sophisticated, people that think they don't have the funds to get an attorney, are really at the mercy of these debt buyers.
What's the solution? Are there solutions?
Well, you know, I suppose one solution would be to enact court rules, stricter court rules, on the type of evidence a debt buyer has to produce, even to get a default judgment, even if the debtor doesn't show up to contest it, to make the debt buyer produce credible evidence that person actually owed the debt. Something other than these robo-signed affidavits that are based on some part-time employee looking at a computer screen all day long. And that would be one thing that I think would be effective at the court level. As for, you know, just the problem itself, it goes much deeper into the economy. It goes into the reason for credit card debt in the first place and the kinds of debt that consumers get hooked into. I was sitting in court one day, and I noticed that almost every case that was called, it was a credit card company. These weren't debt buyers. This is the credit card company actually suing. Every case that was called, the amount in dispute the debt was about $1,200, between $1,000 and $1,200. And after a while, I realized what was going on because I know about this one aspect of the industry. There are such things as fee harvester credit cards is what they're called. And those cards are typically ones in which a company – credit card company will flood a certain zip code with credit card offers for these credit cards that have a high origination fee, that have high late payment fees, that have very high over-limit fees. And so they would, and this particular company would flood this one zip code with credit cards that had a low limit, say $500. The origination fee was something like $100, so there's already 100 of the 500 limit used up with that, and then would have very high late payment fees. And so it did not take very long to build up enough in late fees, origination fees, over limit fees to get the card up to about $1,200, and then the credit card company would cut it off and then sue the debtor. And so they were, they had it figured out to, you know, a bean counter's exact science of how many people you could hook on these things, how long you can let them go and cut them off, and then get a $1,200 judgment against them and run garnishments to collect it. And You know, I just imagine some MBA sitting in a back room somewhere dreaming this scheme up and thinking it was brilliant.
That is truly that's truly a sad state of affairs. Dale, I appreciate you being on air with us today. You've been listening to Jaws of Justice on KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio. Our guest today has been Dale Irwin, consumer lawyer here in Kansas City. I'm Robin Martinez, a member of the Kansas City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, and I want to thank you for listening today.
Now, the calendar for November 23rd, 2015. The Kansas City, Missouri Police Department invites you to the grand opening of the new Leon Mercer Jordan Campus, East Patrol Division, and Regional Crime Lab on Tuesday, December 1st, from 1 to 6:30 p.m. at 2640 Prospect Avenue, KCMO. Tours of the campus will be held from 1 to 3 p.m. and again 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. The ribbon cutting and dedication ceremony will be held from 3:30 to 4:30 p.m. Voices of the People and Representative Brandon Ellington invite you to the 9th Annual Community Thanksgiving Dinner on Wednesday, November 25th, 4 p.m. at Brush Creek Community Center, 3801 Emmanuel Cleaver II Boulevard, KCMO. If you wish to donate food items or gently used clothing for the giveaway, you can call the office at 573-571-3129 or by email at brandon.ellington.mo.gov or voicesofthepeople.votp@gmail.com. The CASA organizations in our area have a mission to empower abused and neglected children with a volunteer's voice in court and by seeking a safe and permanent home for each child. If you would like to find out more about volunteering, you can contact Jackson County CASA, that's C-A-S-A, at 816-984-9208 or on their website, Jackson County CASA-MO.org or CASA of Johnson and Wyandotte Counties at 913-715-4040 or send an email to CASAweb@CASAJWC.com. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Because of a miscommunication, Lane Roberts, director of the Missouri Peace Officer Standards and Training Commission, was unable to join the show last week. We are in the process of rescheduling with him. We ask you to tune in next week to Jaws of Justice Radio for a show that is still being chiseled into the stone tablet as we broadcast today. We also want to thank Mike Murphy of the Wednesday Morning Buzz for engineering today's show.
Good morning. You're listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio in Kansas City. I'm Robin Martinez, an attorney with the law firm of Martinez, Madrigal & Ochocow, and I'm a member of the Kansas City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. Here with me today is Dale Irwin. Dale is an attorney with the Kansas City law firm of Slough, Keneally, or Irwin & Madden. And Dale is a well-known consumer lawyer here in Kansas City, having represented the interests of consumers for any number of years. I won't say how many, but quite a few. And today we've got a very interesting topic for consideration, and that is payday lending. Payday lending is one that is a significant, has a significant effect on consumers, particularly low middle-income consumers in America, and really touches on a lot of issues affecting economic justice. Earlier today, I pulled some numbers from the Center for Responsible Lending and found it remarkable that since its inception in the 1990s, the payday lending industry has set up over 22,000 locations and originate anywhere over $27 billion in annual loan volume. And that if you look at the number of payday lending locations and storefronts nationwide, there are more than two for every single Starbucks location, which is pretty remarkable when we consider that for those of us who drink coffee, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to go anywhere without seeing a Starbucks. But yet there are even more payday lending locations. Dale, welcome to Jaws of Justice.
Thank you, Robin.
Tell us a little bit about payday lending. I know that you've been very involved in payday lending issues over the years. And tell us how you really got interested in the subject and what you've been working on.
Well, I guess my interest stemmed from childhood. I grew up, my mother supported six of us by herself, and she was always in debt to a local loan company. And when I got old enough to understand these type of things, and I went off to college and law school, I realized what was going on when I started looking at her loan documents, how much they were packing into the loan for credit insurance and property insurance and all these fake charges to boost up the effective rate of interest on these loans. And I saw how these lenders would take advantage of people that were of modest means or poor, I guess, if you want to call it what it is, and ignorant, and not in the sense of stupid, simply not being very financially literate. And I saw how, you know, the cynicism with which these kinds of lenders would take advantage of the poor. And one quote it's always stuck with me is a quote by James Baldwin. And James Baldwin said something to the effect of, "It is expensive to be poor." And when you look at the fact that the average payday loan rate of interest is 445%, you get a sense of what Baldwin was talking about. Now, I know that the payday lenders will say, well, you know, that 445% is an annual percentage rate. You can't really judge it by that because they're short-term loans and da-da-da. And my response to that is, well, the next time you get stopped by a cop for doing 100 miles an hour in a speed trap, try saying, "But officer, I haven't been driving for an hour," and see how that goes over. 445% annual percentage rate is just that. It's a 445% annual percentage rate, and it traps people in these types of loans. Usury has been something that has been immoral and illegal, stretching back to biblical times, and I'm hard-pressed to understand why somehow in the 80s and early 90s it all of a sudden became okay to take advantage of desperate people.
Well, that's a good question, Dale, because I think a lot of us are under the assumption that that various states have usury statutes that prohibit lenders from charging phenomenally excessive rates like that. Why is that not the case?
Well, Missouri used to. One of the first class, well, the first class action I ever worked on, I was a legal aid lawyer in the late 1970s. And there were some guys out of Oklahoma that had come to Kansas City and opened up four or five loan shops. And back then, we did have usury statutes limiting how much interest you could charge. They were trying to get around the usury statute by saying that they weren't charging interest. What they were charging was a, quote, brokerage fee, meaning that they'd loan you $50, but they would charge you an outrageous amount of money for finding you somebody to borrow that 50 from. They called themselves just loan brokers. Oddly enough, they always got the loan from the same guy, some guy named Morris Rubin in El Paso, Texas. And we never did determine whether there really was a guy of that name. They said he was in his 90s, and so we couldn't take his deposition. But at any rate, we succeeded in settling that class action, and then we got Karen, her name was Benson then, Karen McCarthy later. She was in the state legislature, and she introduced a bill to plug that loophole in the usury statute they were trying to exploit. And this is in the early 80s by then, and the payday lending interest challenged that statute, took it all the way to the Missouri Supreme Court, and the Missouri Supreme Court upheld it. And so, undaunted, they started going to the legislature. And they got the legislature to pass a bill legalizing them. Their lobbyist was a guy named John Britton, who was referred to in Jefferson City as the senator from Bush, because he was Anheuser-Busch's lobbyist, too. And they got that bill through. Governor Kit Bond was the governor at that time, and we mounted a veto campaign. And to Kit Bond's everlasting credit, he vetoed that bill. They came back and got another bill through the legislature. This time, John Ashcroft is the governor. We mount the same veto campaign. We figure this should be a walk in the park, preacher's son. You know, he'll see the right thing to do here. And, of course, our pleas fell on deaf ears, and Ashcroft signed it into law. And that was in, I guess, the early 90s. And so ever since then, the sky's been the limit on interest rates. In 98, Senator Jim Mathewson from Sedalia, a Democrat, introduced a bill in the legislature to rip the lid off of the Small Loan Act and remove all usury limits. And again, that was passed into law in 1998, and all the other consumer statutes that try to limit interest, like the Motor Vehicle Time Sales Act, which governs credit sales of cars, none of them have caps on them anymore. The sky is the limit.
Open season, then. Lenders can charge whatever they want. Is that correct?
Exactly.
In the state of Missouri?
Exactly.
Now, you threw out a number earlier, 400 and some percent. Is the annual interest rate being charged by payday lenders. Is that an average rate that you find here in Missouri? And how does that compare, for instance, with what payday lenders are doing in other states?
Missouri is one of the worst states in the country, really. And but in other states where payday lending is, quote, legal, the rates will still run in triple digits. Anywhere from 100 to 500%.
Now, the payday lenders, one of the arguments that I've heard them make is that the loans they're making are of a much riskier nature, and that because those loans are riskier, they deserve to be paid a significant premium for taking on that risk. What's your response to that?
Well, you know, we've tried to get the legislature to reform payday lending in Missouri for a long time. We took a busload of people from Christ the King Parish down to Jeff City, I think it was in 2000, and tried to get some reforms passed. And although we didn't get interest rates pulled back, we did get one provision in the law that required the Division of Finance every 2 years to report on the state of payday lending in Missouri. And one of the things they had to report was the default rate on payday loans, and it's consistently, ever since that bill was enacted, every report has consistently shown that the default rate on payday loans is around 6%, which is not all that high. And one of the reasons for that is that these payday loans are hooked into people's checking accounts. They often are set up for automatic withdrawal so that they're not risky loans at all in that sense. The other side of that is the cost of credit. If you've got any money in a savings account, you know how much banks are paying you these days, and you know how cheap it is to borrow money. Interest rates are at historical lows right now. And that is makes charging 445% when the cost of the money you're loaning out is far less than that, makes it all the more egregious in my view.
So it sounds like the payday lenders then are incredibly profitable with the spread that they're charging and then such a low default rate.
Well, we have, if you want to look, in Kansas City, we've got some of the bigger payday lenders. One's a guy named Tucker. He's an internet payday lender who's hooked up with relationships with Indian tribes so he could glom on to their immunity, their sovereign immunity. But at any rate, he's a convicted felon, and he has his own Ferrari racing team and is just loaded, scads and scads of money. It's an extremely profitable industry. There's some guy in Tennessee that's got a, I think he's got a baseball stadium on his property. The obscene amounts of money that are made in that, quote, industry, it's unbelievable. And again, it is all made on the backs of mainly poor, financially unsophisticated, desperate people.
Again, you're listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio in Kansas City. I'm Robin Martinez, an attorney with the Kansas City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. And here with me today is Dale Irwin, a consumer lawyer in Kansas City with Slough, Keneally, Irwin, and Madden. Now, Dale, you've just told us a little bit about just the obscene profits that are being made by some of these payday lenders and the effect that that has on primarily people who are poor, and that it's really poor people that are paying the freight for that. Let's dig a little bit deeper into the weeds maybe and tell us a little bit about how the payday lending process works. What happens when somebody goes and walks into one of these storefronts and gets a payday loan?
Gosh, I don't know. I've never gotten one. they're generally presented with a take it or leave it loan agreement to sign. In one class action we did, what the payday lender would do would would have the borrower sign a post-dated check. Our particular client borrowed $500 and then gave the payday lender a post-dated check for $600, $100 being the interest that would be due in 2 weeks on that $500 loan. If there's not money in the checking account to satisfy that $600 check at the end of those 2 weeks, then the loan gets renewed. And I think they can be renewed in Missouri up to four times. And so there's another $100 in interest. And so by the end of four renewals, you've got $500 in interest charged on a $500 loan. And then what happens is that if the borrower still doesn't have enough to pay off the loan at the end of that last renewal, then you just go to another payday lender and borrow from Peter to pay Paul and start going through the same cycle and getting buried deeper as you go along. And I've seen people that have had, you know, $10,000, $15,000 in outstanding payday loan debt and are simply just paying the interest on all of it and drowning in it. I noticed a big increase.
So, Dale, we have consumers then that are drowning in debt, largely due to the incredibly excessive interest rates being charged on these payday loans. Now, how does the payday loan business go about deciding where they're going to set up shop?
Well, again, I've never talked to anybody in that business and asked them that question, but if you drive around town, it's obvious that the biggest concentration of payday loans, title loans, those types of high-cost consumer credit are in the poor zip codes in Kansas City. We're sitting here at 39th and Main, and within a block of us there are three or four payday lenders. The same thing is true if you go down Troost or you go anywhere on the east side. The city, I think, passed an ordinance to try and thin out the concentration of these types of lenders, and that ordinance is currently being challenged in federal court by one of these high-cost lenders. It's obvious to me what the target area is.
And that target area is?
In lower economic sections of town.
Effectively, they're making their money off of poor people.
Effectively, they are.
What could be done to address this problem of payday lending?
Well, one thing that's not going to be done is any kind of reform in the legislature. I was involved with a group that attempted to get an initiative petition on the ballot this past November, and our initiative petition would have put a cap on interest rates in Missouri at 36%.
Well, that's still fairly high rate compared to...
That is a fairly high rate. The last time we had a cap on small loans, it was back in the 90s, and it was 26.62%. And so that at least would give lenders plenty of room to make money, for sure, but would take the problem of 445% interest rates off the table. Our initiative petition unfortunately didn't make it on the ballot. We got enough signatures all around the state except for the signature validation process in St. Louis fell short, and that was why we didn't make it on the November ballot. The payday lending industry got all the money and lawyers it could, and we fought them all the way up to the Missouri Supreme Court on one issue, and they kept they're going to pour any resources and money it took into that campaign to stop us, because they know that once it gets on the ballot, it's going to pass overwhelmingly, as it did in Arizona, as it did in Montana, as it did elsewhere. They spent $20 million in Arizona once it got on the ballot to try and defeat it, and it still passed, I think, 60% to 40%. So, the people know that this is outrageous, what's going on. But, of course, the legislature is subject to money and lobbyists. State Auditor Tom Schweik, during our initiative campaign, was being sued every which way by the payday lending industry, and he... He's in Jefferson City, and he said that Jefferson City is awash in payday loan money, and he hit it right on the head. Nothing's going to change down there. It's going to have to be by an initiative.
What about redress in the courts? What can consumers who are struggling and in trying to deal with these punitive interest rates, what can they do to fight
that? Well, that goes actually to the U.S. Supreme Court, which came down this past summer in a case called Concepcion, in which the U.S. Supreme Court gave its blessing to businesses that put arbitration clauses in consumer contracts.
What are arbitration clauses?
Arbitration clauses basically take away your right to go to court and say you have to take your dispute to arbitration. And they also say that you can't bring a claim as a class action. So as a practical matter, by taking away your right to go to court and taking away your right to file something on a class-wide basis, consumers are handcuffed, because nobody is going to find a lawyer to take a $50 or $100 dispute over a payday loan through an individual arbitration. It makes no economic sense. And so if you can't band together a bunch of those small $100 cases into a class action, then you have effectively eliminated any threat from consumers, and you have found a way to cheat and steal any way you want to without having to be called to task for it.
And the U.S. Supreme Court gave its blessing to this. Is that right?
Yes, arbitration clauses in general in consumer contracts. They're in every contract a consumer signs. If you buy a car, if you take out a loan, if you buy a house, your Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial is effectively taken away by that contract. And most people, well, I would say 99% of the people that sign contracts don't realize what an arbitration clause is. They can put it in 16-point type, and people will not realize the significance of what it actually means. The creditors and the lenders will tell them, well, this makes it easier to resolve disputes. Of course, it makes it easier for them because the dispute doesn't get brought in the first place.
Thank you very much, Dale. This has been a fascinating discussion. I wish we had more time, but I think our time today is at an end. You've been listening to Jaws of Justice, KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio here in Kansas City. I'm Robin Martinez with the Kansas City Chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. With me today has been consumer lawyer Dale Irwin with Slough, Keneally, Irwin & Madden, and I want to thank you for listening.
It's the 420 Drug War News. An ongoing drug epidemic has swept the United States, killing hundreds and sickening thousands more on a daily basis. The widespread use of this drug has been linked to erratic and even dangerous behavior, ranging from college students running naked down public streets to brutal attacks and robberies. Federal officials suggest this drug has already been linked to 88,000 deaths a year across the country, including traffic accidents caused by drug-induced impairment, liver damage caused by excessive consumption, and violent behavior. Experts warn that it can also lead to nausea, vomiting, severe headaches, cognitive deficits among children and teens, and even fetal defects in pregnant women. This excessive consumption is, quote, a leading cause of preventable deaths in the United States, end quote. So said the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Principal Deputy Director Yanis Arias. She said we need to implement effective programs and policies to prevent this habit and the many health and social harms that are related to it, including death and poisoning. As was recently seen in New Orleans, the horror of this drug was particularly prominent in the city's French Quarter, where hundreds of young adults could be seen roiling from the effects of the drug. Some collapsed on the ground, dazed from the effects. Others could be seen vomiting in public. Many could be seen limping and clumsily walking down the street, showcasing the type of impairment that public health officials warn can lead to accidents, especially when someone is behind the wheel of a car. What's worse, public use of this drug has become widely accepted in many circles. Again, in New Orleans, several men and women in their 20s and 30s shouted that they were going to get wasted, a slang term for coming under the effects of this drug. Some have even turned it into a game that involves ping-pong balls and plastic cups. In other places, there have been similar reports of individuals engaging in bizarre, inexplicable behavior while under the effects of this drug. Some reports found college students exposing themselves to others or running the streets naked while shouting hysterically, particularly during the spring. Others report urinating in public streets, and at least one man tried to ride a crocodile and was seriously injured while using this drug. One law enforcement official said they have no control over their thoughts. They cannot control their actions. It's just a dangerous, dangerous drug. And, of course, the drug is alcohol. Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.